When the ball drops on the year 2000, it will be a momentous event for the world and for the U.S. economy, which is closing in on its longest expansion ever. The decade has been marked by strong growth, the lowest unemployment in a generation, and yet remarkably little inflation. Well, tonight we ring in a special Millennium series here on Moneyline, The New Economy. Is it a boom without end? Over the next 2 weeks, we'll cross the country trying to answer a key question. Has the 1990s boom shattered old assumptions about how the economy works and how fast it can grow? We begin tonight with an in-depth look at the debate and at what's at stake. Peter Viles has the story.
Would everybody else turn off their cell phone?
It's first year economics at New York University, and Professor Mark Lieberman is talking Wall Street.
But the question is, how long can Amazon.com's revenues continue to grow?
His students are mostly freshmen who came of age during an unprecedented era of prosperity. They have no experience with a world marked by runaway inflation, high unemployment, or market crashes. And some think it's a boom without end.
I have a number of students who fully expect to be billionaires by the time they hit their 30s.
But as Lieberman teaches economic rules, some say those rules are being rewritten.
It's a question now being debated in classrooms, in boardrooms, and here on Wall Street. Have technology, globalization, and free trade come together to create a truly new economy, one that allows for strong growth and little inflation?
The market's future and the nation's continued prosperity depend on the answer. The economy this century is a regular series of booms and busts.
To the greatest crash in the history of the New York Stock Exchange.
Since 1920, recessions have occurred nearly twice a decade. But since 1991, the economy has expanded in what's about to break the record as America's longest boom. If anything, the economy is speeding up, going way faster since 1995 than once thought possible, without sparking inflation. Low inflation has led to low interest rates, an ideal environment for stocks to soar.
2-3, 10 down, 2 down.
And soar they did, the Dow nearly quadrupling since the expansion began. The question, though, has the economy changed for good?
That Cold War between economic growth and inflation is over.
For Ed Yardeni, top economist at Deutsche Bank Securities, it's not just a clever metaphor. He says the new economy rose from the rubble of the Berlin Wall.
If we're in a new economy where productivity can accelerate indefinitely, then there's no stopping at today's stock market, even at today's presumably lofty levels. And so the great wealth-generating machine really is unconstrained in that climate. But if we're in an economy where the old rules come into play from time to time, then much of what has happened in the 1990s will ultimately be challenged. And that'll make a lot of people unhappy. So the debate is intense because personal fortunes are at risk.
And so is the future of a whole generation.
Remember what a share of stock gives you.
Professor Lieberman has his own assessment. The economy is growing faster than once thought possible, but it's not clear whether that will last. His students, as well as investors and American workers, can only hope that the roaring 90s will stretch on after the ball drops. Peter Viles, CNN Financial News, New York.
Hi, everybody. This is Brett, and today is November 7th, 2010. This is the second installment in my recent discussion with former teacher Rich Nastro. The title of this episode is A History Teacher Walks Away from Government School, Part 2. Now, much of our discussion today focuses around economics, the current crisis, and what it means for the future. You might have noticed in the last year or two that there are a lot of very friendly-looking people with big smiling faces on television that want to explain the current financial crisis to the large group of confused public school graduates who tune into the cable news channels each night. Well, most of their discussions seem to focus on what should be done, and not too much on the root causes. The best you'll get from most people is that it was a problem of not enough government, not enough regulation, and how the government needs to step in and do more, and what will happen if they don't. So I wanted to start today's show with a little bit of a montage that looks at this growing crisis over the course of the last decade. And even though I hope this is a little bit more complete picture, I trace most of the serious problems of today to two roots. Number one is government education. Number two is people's acceptance of aggression to solve complex problems. So let's get started. Today's show is subtitled, Is Anyone Learning About Economics in School?
Anyone? In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the, anyone? The Great Depression, passed the, anyone? A tariff bill, the Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which... Anyone raised or lowered? Raised tariffs in an effort to collect more revenue for the federal government. Did it work? Anyone? Anyone know the effects? It did not work, and the United States sank deeper into the Great Depression. Today, we have a similar debate over this. Anyone know what this is, class? Anyone? Anyone? Anyone seen this before? Anyone?
This has nothing to do with free market capitalism. This has to do with a managed economy, an inflationary system, corporatism, a special interest system.
For the past several years, everybody thought we had a real economy. We didn't. We had a bubble. All we did is borrow trillions of dollars from the rest of the world, and we blew all the money on consumption. We can't pay the bills. The asset bubbles that were inflated by reckless monetary policy are deflating around us.
We're looking at a symptom. We're looking at the collapsing of a market that was unstable. It was unstable because of the way it came about. It came about because of a monopoly control of money and credit by the Federal Reserve System, and that is a natural consequence of what happens when a Federal Reserve System creates too much credit.
This wasn't created by the free market. All this excess leverage is there because of the government. It's there because of the Fed. They did this. They infected us with this disease. The fact that all these companies are now dying.
How did Wells Fargo make stupid home equity loans?
What they did is they provided Wells Fargo. And all these companies with free money, and they let them go out and leverage it up. And it's like I use the analogy, if your kindergarten school teacher leaves the classroom and passes out pixie sticks and soda pop, and then leaves the classroom and she comes back and the kindergartners have wrecked the place, who do you blame?
Where do you draw the line with our money?
It is not your money. In fact,
it is taxpayers' money.
We'll get it passed. I came back and suspended my campaign.
Mr. President, I've received 91,000 phone calls and emails from California. 85,000 of them opposed to this measure. I think if we really do care about the livelihood of our constituents, there's only one vote, and it is yes.
And in the end of the day, there's no real separation between Wall Street and Main Street. There's only the road we're traveling on as Americans. I urge my colleagues to join me in supporting this important legislation.
And it comes down to one word, jobs. Jobs, so we can create jobs in our country. People have to know that this isn't about a bailout of Wall Street.
We look forward to working closely with Congress to resolve this financial crisis.
So I propose that the federal government reduce the risk posed by these troubled assets and supply urgently needed money so banks and other financial institutions can avoid collapse and resume lending.
Low interest rates, an ideal environment for stocks to soar.
Joseph Gallivan shares a front row seat at the tech wreck, chronicling the carnage in his New York Post column, dead.com of the day.
We terminated virtually all our employees Tuesday. Technically speaking, we're not out of business. We hit a liquidity crisis.
Already more than 200 dot-coms have gone bust, and another 20 die each month. Remember the old days, the mid-90s. Then the streets of Silicon Alley ran with gold. The internet was a revolutionary force, the economy an unstoppable train, and the boring old business cycle was declared dead.
8,000, 10,000, 12,000.
It was in the midst of this frenzy that investors queued up to throw money into the bonfire. The hype ran rampant.
They were one of the best examples of a company that was built on hype.
You know, Amazon burns through $1 billion a year. No one raises an eyebrow. We burn through 50 and people are like, oh my God. No. I mean, it's all relatively speaking. We lived through a mania.
There was an old lady who swallowed a fly. I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die.
The right of every family to a decent home.
Try to make the dream of homeownership more achievable. Our government is supporting homeownership.
Politicians had this goal of being able to wave about the claim that
homeownership rates are at an all-time high.
They encourage banks and other lending institutions to make loans to people that the banks and lending institutions themselves would not have done. They would not have taken on that level of risk. At the insistence of Congress.
I think we see entities that are fundamentally sound financially.
Congress told big government-sponsored companies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, buy up more home loans.
This is not the dot-com situation. We have problems with people having invested in business plans for which there was no reality. The people building fiber optic cable for which there was no need. Homes that are occupied may see an ebb and flow in the price at a certain percentage level, but you're not going to see the collapse that you see when people talk about a bubble. And so those of us on our committee in particular will continue to push for home ownership.
There was an old lady who swallowed a spider that wriggled and jiggled and tickled inside her. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die.
Okay, Peter writes, should I be worried about Bear Stearns in terms of liquidity and get my money out of there? No, no, no. Bear Stearns is fine. Do not take your money out. This is real. Look, if there's one takeaway other than a plus 400 somewhere, Bear Stearns is not in trouble. I mean, if anything, they're more likely to be taken over. Don't move your money from Bear. That's just being silly. Don't be silly.
Okay, just so you get a sense of what's causing the agony, by this point, I know you've been talking about it. It's financials led by Bear Stearns after what essentially is a bailout from the Fed. Bear Stearns shares down 90% this morning, and it's not just Bear. Pretty much every single bank is plunging in early trade this morning. Lehman, which is very similar to Bear and its reliance on fixed income, is down nearly 30%. You have big names like Goldman Sachs down 8%, Citigroup down 8%. So it is pain across the board this morning, and as you know, it all emanates from the shock this weekend that J.P. Morgan, along with the Fed, was going to be bailing out Bear Stearns for $2 a share.
There was an old lady who swallowed a bird. How absurd to swallow a bird. She swallowed the bird to catch the spider that wriggled and jiggled and tickled inside her. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she swallowed that fly. Perhaps she'll die.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is trying to persuade American politicians to back a $700 billion bailout of the country's financial system.
Over these past days, it has become clear that there is a bipartisan consensus for an urgent legislative solution. We need to build upon this spirit and enact this bill quickly and cleanly and avoid slowing it down with provisions that are unrelated or don't have broad support. This troubled asset purchase program on its own is the single most effective thing we can do to help homeowners, the American people, and to stimulate our economy.
But not everyone is convinced the plan will work. Our correspondent Greg Wood reports now from New York.
It's a massive addition to the national debt, equivalent to more than $5,000 for every U.S. taxpayer. There's growing anger among ordinary people about the extra burden they're being asked to take on.
I think it's criminal. I think it's paying bail for criminals who have no accountability, and we're just paying for them for no reason at all. I don't see the benefit. They want to let the market operate freely, let them go out of business.
One of the questions being asked by people here on the streets is why their money should be used to rescue banks who pay their executives multi-million dollar bonuses.
Many of us were told in private conversations that if we voted against this bill on Monday, that the sky would fall, the market would drop 2,000 or 3,000 points the first day, another couple thousand the second day, and a few members were even told that there would be martial law in America if we voted no. That's what I call fear-mongering.
There was an old lady who swallowed a cat. Imagine that, she swallowed a cat. She swallowed the cat to catch the bird. She swallowed the bird to catch the spider that wriggled and jiggled and tickled inside her. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she swallowed that fly. Perhaps she'll die.
Foreclosures reach an all-time high. Stocks drop 800 points the day before.
These people are saying, we've got to fix it. Give us the authority. And look what's happening. It's getting worse, not better.
I have a duty to try to protect those people.
Taking billions from taxpayers and giving it to these banks that made stupid decisions is going to help those people?
We've got to stop the bleeding.
Are you sure it's right for the government to do something? Maybe the government should do nothing.
But the problem is we can't afford to continue to do nothing. We can't afford to continue to do nothing.
There was an old lady who swallowed a dog. What's a hog to swallow a dog? She swallowed the dog to catch the cat. She swallowed the cat to catch the bird. She swallowed the bird to catch the spider that wriggled and jiggled and tickled inside her.
The problem is when you start saying, nobody can make a bad decision. We'll always take care of you.
She swallowed the spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die.
Congressman Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have a serious problem. We don't talk about much how we got here. We talk about how we're going to patch it up. The bubble has been burst. We saw what happened after the NASDAQ bubble burst. We don't ask how it was created, and then we have a housing bubble, and it's deflating and it's spreading. And yet nobody says, where does it come from? And what is the advice that you generally get? And that is, inflate the currency. They don't say inflate the currency. They don't say debase the currency. They don't say devalue the currency. They don't say cheat the people who are saved. They say lower the interest rates. But they never ask you, and I don't hear you say too often, the only way I can lower interest rates is I have to create more money. I have to lower the discount rate. I have to make it generous. I have to increase reserves. I have to lower the interest rates and fix the interest rates, overnight rates. And the only way you can do this is by increasing the money supply. And I see this as the problem that we don't want to talk about. This was taught by the free market economists all through the 20th century. They said, beware. They will increase the money supply, but they will make you concentrate on prices. And they will give you CPIs and PPIs, and they'll fudge those figures, and they'll talk about wage and price controls to solve our problems. And we ignore the fundamental flaw, and that is that not only have we had a subprime market in housing, the whole economic system is subprime in that we have artificially low interest rates. And it wasn't under your tenure in office. It's been going on for 10 years or longer, and now we're bearing the fruits of that policy. When the Fed fixes an interest rate at 1%, that is price fixing. So I think we have to get back to the very fundamentals of where this problem comes from. And the bubbles occur when we have this malinvestment and the creation of new money. So my question boils down to this. How in the world can we expect to solve the problems of inflation, that is, the increase in the supply of money, with more inflation? But how can you do this and pursue this, the policy you have, without further weakening the dollar? There's a dollar crisis out there, and people's money is being stolen. People who have saved, they're being robbed.
If somebody has their wealth in dollars and they're going to buy consumer goods in dollars, and it's a typical American, then the decline in the dollar, the only effect it has on their buying power is it makes imported goods more expensive.
Yeah, but not if you're retired and elderly and you have CDs and their cost of living is going up no matter what your CPI says. Their cost of living is going up and they're hurting, and that's why the people in this country are very upset.
Well, we have a certain level of anxiety up here, Mr. Chairman.
I believe that more action is going to be necessary. The economic emergency is growing more severe. Jobs are down. Wages are falling. The financial markets threaten to be engaged in a protracted credit crunch with long-lasting ramifications for investment, job creation, and family incomes. And this is an emergency that you feel not only just from reading the Wall Street Journal, but from traveling across Ohio and Michigan, in New Mexico and Nevada, where you meet people day after day who are one foreclosure notice or one illness or one pink slip away from economic disaster.
There was an old lady who swallowed a goat, just opened her throat and swallowed a goat. She swallowed the goat to catch the dog. She swallowed the dog to catch the cat. She swallowed the cat to catch the bird. She swallowed the bird to catch the spider that wriggled and jiggled and tickled inside her. She swallowed the spider to catch the fly, but I don't know why she swallowed the fly. Perhaps she'll die.
I got really bothered, you know, reading the history textbooks. And I can see why the kids hate it so much, because it'll be like in the French Revolution, it'll say it was caused because Louis XVI was a quote-unquote weak leader.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah, it's always about something the government is not doing enough of.
Right.
Whenever there's a problem, yeah, not enough government. Right,
right, exactly. Right. And they said that the French Revolution, and then, again, words not deeds matter, and they talk, I mean, the French Revolution is celebrated as if it's a good thing, but, you know, looking at what happened and all the, you know, the Reign of Terror and the Napoleonic Wars afterwards, and the, you know, the books will treat Napoleon as a hero, because unlike Louis XVI, Napoleon was willing to exercise power more ruthlessly. And so I'm reading that in it, you know, and again, like the economics book will say, some people say the government needs to smooth out the excesses of capitalism. Other people say the government doesn't. I mean, what does that mean?
Nothing. You know, sounds like Fox News.
Right. I mean, there's no theory. And then you give all these facts about, you know, what does it mean without knowing why they're important? And so there's no, I mean, the way these books are written, I didn't want to use them, but because of time, I kind of had to have something. Because I couldn't, you know, rewrite textbooks for both classes. But even that, I mean, I can see the kids' angst. Because the kids kind of, they don't know what's wrong, but they can tell that they're being, you know, they can tell that there's something not right about what the system. They just don't know exactly what it is.
Yeah, and I think they maybe can even identify some of them, because one kid called me on it once, how even as I, you know, took a more revisionist stance on history in the early in my career, and I started introducing people like Howard Zinn and Chomsky into the mix a little bit, James Lowen, you know, this one kid called me on it, you know, some white guy always rides in the end to save the day. And of course, that's a very liberal version of history, the Johnsons and the Roosevelts and, the other Roosevelt and the Wilson, kind of stories where, the government comes in and saves the day. And the whole history curriculum itself is kind of like a supplemental material in the training, for authority worship. Right, because
exactly.
It's always the authorities, it's always the government, it's always the father figures who save the day.
Exactly, and it's just simply not true. You can do more for yourself than an Abraham Lincoln can do for you. And as you were covering one of your broadcasts, you know, the kids kind of get a sense of they'll never be Abraham Lincoln or, you know, or Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And then we're
right.
Supposed to wait around for some, you know, hero to seize government power to make the world, you know, great. And it's not, you know, we're just, as long as we find the right dictator, right leader to lead us. And that model is really corrupting to somebody's ability to become a rational and philosophical thinker. And if you do teach the truth, and it happened a little bit on my, you know, private school, I had to dance around it. Someone would say, you know, if I pointed out that Social Security, for example, that trust fund only contains promises, not real money, someone was saying I was exercising an opinion.
You know, right.
And that's just I'm indoctrinating the kids, just like, you know, another liberal professor is at, you know, at CU Boulder.
Yeah. Because everything needs to be reduced to relativism. Like, it's very, very intimidating when somebody has to deal with the idea that something could actually be a fact.
Right.
Because if something is verifiable, if something is axiomatic, and it's challenging the conventions that most people are believing right now, well, some action is probably going to have to follow that up. Maybe it might even be personal action that requires a lot of courage. And unfortunately, most people are, you know, I'm not saying they're not capable of it, but for whatever reason, a lot of people are not able to muster the courage to apply that in their personal life. So it's easier to pretend that some other story is true that, you know, allows them to keep going along to get along, pretty much.
And that, you know, teaching somebody to wait for someone else to come along to improve society and improve your life is a big lie. You know, there's nobody out there who's going to be interested in your own well-being more than you. And people actually believe they can vote you know, they can use the, I mean, just by checking a box, they can make the world better as if there's no real, that's all there is to it.
Right.
And I don't know. I think it does. I do believe in Molyneux's theories that, you know, at home and how we're treated as children, then, you know, it starts there and then we go to school. But what does happen to the kid who really does challenge, you know, the authority figures? Does he, you know, what reaction does he get?
And one certainly builds on the other, too. I mean, like, if children, if we just had a complete revolution in how people approach child raising in the home, what the family means, government school would stop making sense by the time somebody was 10. And, you know, if that revolution then took place in education, if education was redefined to mean actual learning and not controlling and training children, if this society that we have today could still somehow find a way to exist beyond that, which is doubtful, that would all stop making sense, like right around somebody's 18th birthday or the first time they got a paycheck, for sure. So, yeah, it's a good point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if the, you know, if we had, you know, a free society, then what, you know, what, I don't know what the school system would look like, but, you know, the innovations in the market, and I mean, you wouldn't have a system that has, I mean, hasn't changed, and it gets more and more funding and gets, you know, results get worse and worse. I mean, no, this, you know, in a free market, a school that operates like this one I was at, wouldn't, no one would, you know, no one would pay to send their kids there voluntarily.
Yeah, I have the same experience, indeed. I mean, the school was made possible. You know, I said in a recent show, it was not like something I ever wanted to admit or even realize, and I think I went a long time without looking at it, but I very much made a living on the other side of the gun, because this school would not have existed if it was not for the state and, you know, that sort of unholy nexus that these child services have with child services and Medicare, with the healthcare and pharmaceutical industry. That made that private school and probably many others like it possible.
And, you know, healthy, you know, parents wouldn't want to turn their kids over to government, you know, indoctrination centers type schools.
Right.
You command and control. But one of the things about your work, and you pointed out something, because when you look at what is propping up the existing system, which is, you know, on its last legs, I mean, pretty soon we're going to see, you know, a currency crisis. I don't, you know, I can't even imagine what, I mean, it's hard to imagine exactly what's going to happen. But what's propping up this corrupt system was, you pointed out, was, you know, public education is probably, where do the people get the ideas?
Yeah.
That government should take control of their lives. You know, where do people get the ideas that voting is the way to make us a prosperous place? Where do people get the ideas that the, you know, it's glorious to be a soldier?
It's the linchpin. Yeah, it's really the linchpin.
Where do we get those ideas? I know where I got them. I got them in public schools.
Right.
And so if you were to, if that was to collapse, then, you know, I mean, think about, you know, I mean, it's great for the military if kids look at military as their, you know, as their best option when they're, you know, doing poorly in school. It's, you know, the government growth is going to continue to grow as long as people, you know, support, you know, government power and see taxation or regulation as the answer to every social ill. And where are we getting all those, where is everyone getting those ideas? They're getting it from public schools and the mainstream media.
Right. And I've said before that if the goal of the schools is supposedly education, to really educate people, to really turn them into critical, independent thinkers, if the schools worked, every evil in society would ultimately fail.
The fact that we're in such a crisis now shows how what a failure the schools are. The fact that we have people thinking that you can just print money, that we're fooled by quantitative easing terms, that people, you know, think that that actually is something, that inflation is something that is a good thing, shows you that the people think that, you know, I mean, the lie about, you know, foreign policy, the troops protect our freedom.
It is a very interesting government program because in some ways it is the biggest and most tragic failure. And in other ways, it is like just the most amazing success for what it's been able to do as far as real education versus this, you know, facsimile fake one size fits all indoctrination.
But the hard part is, Brett, is that most you'll find more people critical of the welfare state, more people critical of the warfare state. But how many people really will come out against public education?
No, that's like taboo.
If they were to try to pass a tax increase to increase the war in Afghanistan, would people go along with it?
I seriously doubt it at this point. I hope, anyway.
Arizona, I don't think they would. In Arizona, they passed a tax increase to try to give more money for public education, and it passed. At a time of, you know, so you can use the kids as a way to get taxpayer money. People really, I don't, you know, either they can't see or they won't see or they're just completely unenlightened. But you know, if the public education system is, if this is where all the source of all these corrupting ideas and that's keeping the corrupt system in place, and people don't see what's happening with the public school education system, then the system's going to continue.
Yeah, and that's what we're talking about is like one of the greatest but most simple and obvious tricks of propaganda, and that's mixing the good with the bad, mixing the virtuous with the absolutely horrible and disgusting. The beginning question is, do you love children? Do you care about children? Well, that's the good. And then, they are kind of marched out in front of all of the evil, this coercive system, the lack of negotiation in what it costs every year, the teachers' unions, and all of that becomes synonymous. All that evil becomes synonymous with caring about children. It's like so simple and so genius, and it's such a testament to what the education system does when we look at how many people fall for that over and over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is say, I care about children. I mean, when I saw that first video and there was a kid saying, do you believe me? All you have to do is say your words, I care about children. And then you can, you know, these teachers and educators can just say they care about children. It's for the kid's sake. And no one ever has to, you know, explain whether or not the system is actually serving children or what effects mm-hmm. it's having. And if somebody dares to, like your work, you would be attacked as a guy who, how would the educational establishment treat you? Would there be any honest discussion and debate, or would you be attacked as a guy who, you know, wants to make lives harder for poor children?
Right. And it doesn't even, I mean, the other thing too that people are failing to see, and I really, really hope that the work that so many people who are trying to pursue a path to the freer world will eventually accomplish is the results ultimately don't matter beyond the initial use of force. I don't care if those kids skip out of that building every day on their way home grinning like idiots with a candy cane and just couldn't be happier about the whole experience. It's funded by the threat of violence. But that kind of like that first scenario of happy children skipping home is made impossible by that funding method. Things that are good don't need to be funded coercively. And, I think that's something else that's really being missed in this discussion about education and everything else the government does.
Well, I mean, the idea that people have is that government is just like, I think you had a podcast where there's government is good. Like the government is just like people. And, you know, if there's somebody who's fun to chat with and otherwise, friendly kind of person. You know, people don't understand that government is fundamentally different from all other institutions, and that it it's backed by violence. A lot of people think government's just like a community, a company, a church, even. And there's no mention of how the government relies on force.
Right. Because there are similar institutions, but they all can be summed up under the umbrella term organized crime, government is the most successful form of organized crime because really, really, really in the last century and a half, they've found a way to make it legitimate. And that is the very institution that we've been discussing here today, in my opinion.
Well, they did it by, you know, financing, you know, its expenditures by, you know, debt.
Mm-hmm.
And inflation. I mean, it made people think government could do the impossible and deliver, give us something for nothing. You know, we could fight all these wars. We could have, you know, massive bureaucracies and national, you know, and Medicare. And nobody wanted their taxes to go up. You know, nobody wants to pay for it. So it appeared like government was giving us the something for nothing.
Right.
And now that, I mean, the debt has reached this level, the programs have grown for it, of all these people dependent. And, I mean, there are still people out there who think they're going to be collecting their Social Security.
Yeah.
And though Social Security is completely, you know, there's no money.
And it's amazing, too, like what can be accomplished by trying to use people's good intentions to drive an evil system. People do so much when it comes to education or when it comes to, quote unquote, national security out of their concern for the future, for their children, their very support. Them legitimizing the system in any way, participating in it, is just perpetuating all of this predation against the very children that they're trying to protect. Because, right, you're right, they make it look like some kind of magic trick. They can do anything. The money seems endless. While the children that people are just so concerned about and have no voice, have no power, are completely defenseless, are getting the bill so the older, you know, their parents and their grandparents can feel good about how virtuous they are. It is the most sad and twisted reality, like what this debt really, really means.
No, it really is. I mean, when you hear all this talk about the children and the, you know, election season, all these politicians will, you know, use the children as a reason for all, you know, for all this government expansion. And you think, you know, what has the deficit done for the children? I mean, these kids are graduating, and what type of opportunities do they have?
Right.
You know, looking around, I'm at the children and these kids at the school I'm at, you know, where are the jobs for these kids? You know, let's say they did like, you know, Erica Goldson did and all worked and did so great in high school. And, you know, what can they, I mean, they have the debt is now being financed through inflation, and there's going to be higher taxes. So that's going to, you know, take more capital away and higher prices. You know, when I started, there were more opportunities for me years of each generation, and the opportunities for these kids have been taken away from them.
Yeah. And, you know, Erica said, after all that hard work and all of the effort she put into pleasing other people, to be, in her own words, the best slave, I think that she really, what she communicated was how lost she actually felt when she finally got out of the doors of that fantasy world that is, you know, government high school. And she looked around, and or even as she saw herself coming out and started to think about the future, it was like, why did I do this? What's really here? What have I been working for? You know, all this effort to please other people and be congratulated on all of these arbitrary accomplishments. And that I think that feeling of, you know, doing all that stuff and then getting out to the other side and being like, wow, I am totally lost, because this is not what I expected to find, is really saddening. And one of the things that I've really tried to accomplish with this show is just, you know, to start breaking apart those illusions now, and maybe people can be a little bit more prepared for the reality that follows. But that's tough.
You know, getting the word out. But at least, you know, when I was in school, there was no person who could give a speech like Erica did.
Right.
I mean, we were, you know, the media control all our ideas, and apparently. And so I'm sure Erica, I know a teacher introduced it, but I know that the only ideas that I, you know, it was through what I learned about truth, I didn't learn in school. I found out after school by pursuing my own self-education. So there are more and more kids, and when you introduce, the kids are figuring out more and more that all the you know, the politicians are full of crap.
Right.
That the kids are starting to see that, you know, I mean, in yesterday's election, I think the voter turnout for younger kids was much lower. And for younger people, and I think kids are starting to realize it doesn't make much difference who you vote for. You know, government's going to grow. So, but Erica's situation where you spend all this time and investment in the homework load and the, you know, your whole life is consumed by school. And even while you're at school, socially, you're learning the wrong lessons. What matters is not who you are, but what you look like. You know, what matters is if you have, you know, fashionable clothes. So kids kind of learn the idea. I mean, you know, if you, you know, for girls, what matters more is your ability to, you know, not what you do, but what you look like. And because in school, you know, the girls who are the prettiest are the ones who are most popular. And so girls want to be accepted and valued. And so they attribute, the way to do that is to, you know, focus only on shallow things like their looks and ignore other areas that can really empower them.
Yes, all extrinsic, all rewards, all superficial and shallow.
Exactly.
You're right.
So they leave high school, they graduate from high school, and socially they have no idea what it really takes to really be a person who has confidence in his or her own abilities. It's much tougher than just wearing a nice outfit or, you know, or youthful beauty isn't all that hard for a lot of those girls. And guys think it's about, you know, sports makes them superior to, you know, the athletes are superior to the non-athletes.
Yeah, regardless of gender, I think the specifics you're talking about are accurate. But it is all just something about not being me, not letting people in, you know, putting up this facade, wearing this costume. That is what it's so typical as far as what's coming out of the schools. And you know, it's a good point, too, just, you know, on a positive note. I looked while we were talking. Erica's video is approaching 500,000 views, which I think is great. If I had given that speech in 1995, which never would have happened because I wasn't even in the top 200 in my class, but you know, it would have vanished into the ether.
Yeah, it would have been considered crazy. Somebody put her up to it, and no one would have even discussed any of the, you know, what she was actually talking about. It would have been a kid, just angry kid trying to, you know, no one would even, it would have been shut. You're right, it would have been completely dismissed. But now, because of the facts on the ground, you can't dismiss it. I mean, the kids in the audience hear her speech, and they realize she's right. I never thought about this, but this makes a lot of sense. And why didn't I think about this? It's because my, you know, why wasn't I thinking about this? It's because, you know, we've basically suspended our ability to actually question and think.
So what do you say to the people, your colleagues, your peers, that are left behind in this system? I mean, it reminds me of when Eric and I were talking, she was discussing this one teacher that she had that did have a positive influence. And like I've said so many times before, there are good people working in this system. But, you know, you cut a pretty clear path here in and out saying, no, no way, this is awful, this is abusive. But if you still have friends that do this for a profession, like, what do you say to them? What could you offer them?
Well, I never believe I can tell anybody what right. they should do. I mean, I'm, you know, for me, the situation was not something I mean, these people, if they believe in what they're doing and they need the jobs, I don't think I can tell them they shouldn't do it or, you know, they can make their decision about what's right for them. I do see a lot of teachers in education who, what happens to them is what you've described, you know, when they become, you know, curmudgeons, as you used it. And a lot of teachers end up just going day to day, and it's just about surviving. You know, I don't know what I can say to them that can make the situation better. You know, from my perspective, it was an unhealthy place for me to be. And I didn't like what I saw, and I didn't think it was serving kids. And so I decided that was best for me to not be part of it. But I think a lot of teachers are becoming disillusioned. But you think we've invested so much. I mean, it's hard as a teacher to realize that the system that you work for really is not as, you know, is abusive to kids. I mean, nobody came into the teaching business thinking that they wanted to be in an environment that is abusive to kids. I mean, it's an awful feeling to realize that, you know, what you would hope to be able to do and, you know, the lives and minds you wanted to touch and inspire and see what. So I wish I had some, you know, advice to teachers to make that would be, they could follow and everything could be great. But they have to, you know, decide what's best for them in their own situations and what they can and can't do. If you can reach a few kids, I can understand how it can be worth it. You know, if there's a couple kids, I mean, I know from my last school, when I hear from students thanking me for introducing philosophy and teaching them the truth about economics and so that they're able to, you know, understand what's going on, that makes it a lot, you know, worth it. So if you can reach a few kids, I can see why you want to keep on doing it.
Oh, it's a very gratifying feeling for sure. And it's always, you know, before I started doing this show, and the only feedback I ever had about anything I had done that mattered to me really was from students. Like, it's nice when you work at a school and the administrators or the educational coordinator tells you that you are a good employee. I kind of got over that when I was pretty young.
Yeah, I don't need any, like, you know, when I left, there was no discussion about what was happening at the school. It was nothing more than just, as I expected, a scathing personal attack. And what matters to me is what the students.
Exactly.
And, you know, I not what, you know, some administrator at this school thinks. And right when I got that, some kid on Facebook, former student, told me a thank you, and his approval meant more to me than any public school administrator's approval.
Right. So despite all of our education, we weren't there to please the boss, which is kind of unique.
And the boss right now, I mean, and in a public school, I mean, the quality of the product doesn't matter. So, you know, pleasing the boss, what does that mean if it's not based on the quality of the product?
Right. Well, not rocking the boat is what pleases the boss.
That's exactly what it means, not rocking the boat. And then that means you have to turn a blind eye and, you know, to things that are going on that, you know, you personally disagree with and compromise your principles and not rock the boat, which is something, I didn't want to be around it. And, but with that being said, I was, the School Sucks podcast, you know, I've been listening to you for probably about a year or so. And you'd said some things that really, really resonated with me. And there's a lack of awareness of what's going on in these schools.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I hope as more teachers get disillusioned about what's going on, they do start to do their own investigations and they stumble across some of this stuff, whether it's something that I did or something that Steph did or the Gattos and the Holtz, the people who've really, you know, devoted the last few decades of their life specifically to this issue. I really hope that they, even though I can't always give them options about what they should do or a very clear path about what the future holds, at least maybe some of them will start to say what you said, that maybe I can do this a different way. I said I'd find my own way to do this, and I feel like I have, or I'm on my way to doing that. And I certainly, you know, if it's something that I was able to do, there's so many people who are just stuck in this malaise of this system who could easily do that as well. So with that being said, what do you think you're going to do next?
I don't know what I'm going to do next. I have, you know, a little bit of savings. And, you know, I want to start a business, but given the environment, you can't start a business in this condition. I might, you know, try to learn a trade in the time. I never really was able to learn trade because I spent all my time as a teacher. So I'm going to probably, you know, try to learn a trade. I understand that, you know, I'm going to have to be retrained for some new skills. Because the old skills of being a teacher, you know, and I'm going to need to do something else. But the fight as far as the public education system, the moneyed interest, the financial interest of education is a huge source of revenue for so many people. And they have a large financial interest in basically preventing the truth from ever coming out and attacking whoever is the messenger. Sadly, I'm looking around and, I think there's going to be a major, some type of, you know, currency crisis or dollar devaluation. And then what happens after that? I don't know. And do we become like Cuba, or does the American people kind of, figure out that government, intervention, monetary manipulation, and all that is what brought this on? Are people going to look to a dictator to take more power?
Right. And I just hope, I really hope that enough can be done in the little window of time that we might have here that can start steering people in the other direction. Like all of this is coming down eventually, whether it will happen, you know, quickly and dramatically or very gradually. It's going to take a lot of people with it. Like the problem with society, with any kind of government or authoritarian structure that lasts a long time, is that a lot of people always seem to be kind of huddled underneath it when it collapses. And that's really tragic. So we kind of are, I think what we're trying to do is have people at least start to come out of the shadows a little bit so they can be a safe distance away when everything starts to fall apart here. But all the indicators, I mean, I totally agree with you, all the indicators are saying that this is something that is probably going to happen in our lifetimes. And, you know, while I certainly have plenty of concern for, you know, myself and my future, these kids are really going to take the brunt of it, and maybe something good or something better will emerge out of it. And I think that that's, you know, a lot of our effort is directed towards seeing that become a possibility.
Right. But the kids already are taking the brunt of it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's
already
true.
You know, they're already suffering and hurting. The system right now is already causing, you know, lots of suffering and the kids in hopelessness and despair. As it is now. A lot of people say it's down the road, but it could be sooner than we think. I'm not, and there's no way to time it. But what gives me, you know, some, you know, is the ideas, as Mises said, are powerful. And, I mean, if we were in Nazi Germany, we wouldn't be able to have this conversation. You know, we would be shot already. So there is a certain level of freedom out there that, I mean, the government can only exist as long as it has the support of people.
Right, and they just didn't catch it. I mean, you know, like, they just didn't catch it in time. By the time anybody could have realized anything there, it was too late. And we really are in a race here, in very much, not to borrow somebody else's phrase, but it really is an information war. And I don't like to ever think that we're fighting or waging war. I don't like to use expressions like that. I actually despise expressions like that. But certainly is, you know, a war on reality being fought hard in these schools and by the government and by the media. And our best defensive action is to put as much good information out as possible, as quickly as possible, because it is getting a little tense. I will say that.
Right. I mean, as the economy, you know, continues to deteriorate and its freedoms continue to get lost, and the government makes promises, I mean, it's always the same promise. The government line is always the same. Progress is being made. Whether it's, you know, any situation, you know, Afghanistan, progress is being made. Their economy, progress is being made. But eventually, you know, the economy keeps getting, you know, more businesses are closing and shutting down. And at some point in time, people are going to look for explanations. And the idea that, you know, the government intervention and the idea that the government's essentially planning is producing results, well, that'll, once reality gets to a point where that'll be almost a cruel joke, you know, when things get, and so people will be looking for explanations and they'll be looking for, you know, understanding, and the alternative media sources are able to, you know, those ideas are out there for people to find. And the mainstream media begins to lose more and more credibility once they're, you know, I mean, the things they tell us that aren't true, more and more people are realizing that. And that's why there's a decline in reading of Newsweek and New York Times, and people are now turning to alternative sources for information because they don't trust the mainstream media anymore.
And they're learning and they're opening their eyes, and that statement is actually kind of true. Progress is being made. It's just not the where they're talking about. It's not in the government. All of that is in decline, but a lot of progress is being made. And I'm very hopeful for the future. This is the right time for this information revolution.
I mean, do you believe, Brett, that the political establishment and those who, you know, hold the power in society, do you believe that they will be effectively challenged? In so that they will, you know, relinquish power and allow for a freer society?
No, I don't think that they will accept any kind of challenge.
I guess, I mean, you're hopeful for the future, but you're hoping for a peaceful change from what we have is tyranny to liberty.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are people who, I mean, the powers, you know, for the rulers, I mean, the few rulers, like the current system. And in the past, rulers without an internet, they faced very few challengers. They could just kind of kill all the challengers. Now, you know, if they were to shoot everyone who bought gold, I mean, that they can't do that because there's just too many people who've done that. But you know, are you saying that you believe that we'll have a peaceful society because the ideas of voluntarism will win out in the end?
I certainly hope so. And, you know, if things continue along the same trend that they followed for the last 5 years, as far as the spread of information is concerned, I really all I can say is that I hope it will be peaceful. And I'm thinking that it will be gradual. But, yeah, I mean, there's probably going to be more bad before there's good. I will say that.
Okay, yeah, because, I mean, I think there's going to have to be, I mean, when the people who are dependent on government for Social Security checks and all those, you know, and then there's going to come a point where those promises that the government's made, the government won't, you know, be able to deliver, and you'll have, you know, soldiers not getting paid, you know, veterans and all that.
Well, there's a potential for this chaos that a lot of people don't want to think about and don't want to talk about. But like I said, as it falls apart and all of these, you know, dependents are left struggling out from underneath, yeah, that could definitely be some bad times. And, you know, I'm not even convinced that the state can't find a way to keep going. I mean, I don't know what they would do, but, you know, certainly there's a lot of resources and there's a lot of minds at work propping all of this stuff up. Can they find a way to keep going? And, I mean, obviously, what I would really hope would happen is that people just lose faith slowly enough as these ideas can be propagated that the transition is smooth. Now, that's very wishful thinking. I almost felt like saying to that bureaucrat that I talked about, that I talked to in a couple shows ago, like, we're not planning a revolution. We're not planning an overthrow. We're going to let, you know, the government take care of that on its own. And I felt like saying to him, like, you guys need to slow down because we need to make sure that these ideas are out there before this happens. And you guys are just racing ahead here to collapse.
I mean, the ideas are out there. So it's not like, I mean, that does give the hope, is that the ideas, I mean, the ideas are out there and more people are catching on to them. And there's no way to know what can happen. I think in not too distant future, we're going to face some type of real crisis and hopefully we'll, you know, respond by what's always lifted every society out of poverty. I mean, you know, there is way out. And that's known, it's been tried before, and it's the same thing that will, you know, solve the economic problems that we face today. You know, it's a free market.
I could not agree more, and I think that that's a great note. I mean, we could probably talk for 3 hours here, but we're up against a hard break as I have to run out the door.
All righty, so nice talking to you.
Oh, well, I really appreciate you taking the time to do it, and I will certainly have you back. We should jump into some of these history topics in a little bit more detail, since that's what you were teaching, right?
Yeah, I taught history and government and economics, and we can do that sometime. It'd be great.
Excellent. We will certainly revisit that. Well, thank you very much for your time, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Thanks, Brett. Take care now.
Today's show began with a clip from the 1987 movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where actor and comedian and economist, if those three things don't go together perfectly, Ben Stein lampoons the typical boring high school history or economics teacher. So I thought, before we wrap up today, we could check in with Ben Stein, a conservative economist, 20 years later, as he weighs in 2008 on the emerging financial crisis in the United States. I include this final clip simply to demonstrate what passes as economic expertise today from a small government point of view. Thanks for listening and take care.
I don't think we have a real problem with inflation. The big numbers coming out about inflation had to do with oil prices. They were fed primarily by demand from India and China and the developing countries of Asia. They cannot be controlled by the Federal Reserve Board. They can't be controlled by the U.S. Central Bank. Food prices were a big increase recently. That comes largely from ethanol mandates. The Federal Reserve can do some things, though, to affect the slowdown in a positive way. Supply liquidity, bank stop the banks. And I think, by the way, this is something I wrote about in the Times a few days ago. I don't see why the Fed should not go to the banks and say, we are just not going to let you fail. So don't feel shy about lending. Get the cork out and start lending. And if it's required, if the Chinese or the Singapore people or the petrostates won't buy your stock, we'll buy it. After all, banking is already largely socialized. Let's let the Fed step in and buy. And my wacky friend from CNBC, Jim Cramer,
don't be silly,
has suggested that the Fed buy the mortgage insurance companies, too. Not a bad idea. I mean, he's a wacky guy, but that was a pretty good idea. Anyway, we have not yet figured out how to cure the business cycle. It does look like we're in the downward part of the business cycle now.
Anyone? Something D-O-O economics. Voodoo economics.
There was an old lady who swallowed a horse. She's dead, of course.